but Mazatlan. The head scene there was a happy thing and a groove. So she sat down in Mazatlan and wrote her mother a beautiful people letter. And she found Zonk, and, unexpectedly, the famous Kankizi and beautiful people. But one thing about the beautiful people themselves, namely the Merry Pranksters. She had heard of the fabulous Merry Pranksters even in San Jose. Kizi and Zonk talked about them all the time, of course. The fabulous Babs, the fabulous Mountain Girl, the fabulous Cassidy, Hermit, Hassler, and the rest. She had a prankster name, Black Mariah, but she was not yet a prankster. She was sensitive even to the contours of Kizi's world, too. Sooner or later, Kizi would reunite with the pranksters. Well, put out Zonker's shirt when the coast is clear. Zonker's billowy, faggy-looking shirt. Let him stay out on his jungle run for a while. If he enjoys the fugitive game, why spoil it? Shwap! Flopping lush PV fronds, Kizi thrashes out of the jungle and across the road. Cars? One Mex, one American, coming in pale tan VW? No, no cars, man. And then down across the road to Rocky Scrabble, down by the ocean on the rocks, his heart rattling away, he sinks down in his Cornell Wild running jacket, listening. Whop. Surf hits the rocks, just a little holiday in picturesque PV with the sea kicking up at twilight. He concentrates on the surf. Analogy spoken here? But the surf is too aimless this way. His heart rattles tachycardiac at this speed, and the surf is sinked into another thing whopping against the rocks. Brang! A tin door sound up on the road like the ominous tin car door sounds in HUD always bring on the bad action. Like brown mechs and crew-cut drip-dry American up on the road, eyes rocketing around. Brown mechs puffing, I'm supposed to be off duty now, senor. Kizi faces out to sea, pulls a tablet out of the jacket. Makes the pink cover visible as if to prove just an aimless surf artist, drawing water swells furl by furl like Leonardo, who must have been ahead. All the minute instincts. To sit by the water, drawing the little furls as the water laps up on beach, then starts rolling back toward the sea, and minute little churning furls in the lead edge of the water. He drew it all, furl by furl, like a very meth head, plugged into the great god rotor. More surf, then kaboom! First, they're firing on him. They don't give a shit. Hot pursuit! We got the guns and the rights, signed on this piece of paper here. One move, blow your fucking head off, and you have already moved, Kizi. Hot pursuit. Kaboom! But nothing happens. Silence except for the surf. That is very paranoid, Hondo. Why would they try to blast you out of the tub with elephant guns anyway? It must be workmen using dynamite. So he edges up to the road, and it is workmen all right, sweating and heaving while the green fronds flap up the hill. He'll just sit here and watch them dynamite. Sure, just watch them dynamite while every gringo car comes spinning off the shore drive out here, Baskin-Robbins, tourist, matron look out and say, Hey, honey, that's Ken Kesey! Back into the jungle, Cornell Wild, heart still banging up to the edge of fibrillation, through the lush shadowy danks of the jungle. Well, yes, sir, looky here a minute, what's this? A three-sided hut in the jungle, some kind of woodsman's hut. With a cot in it and a little hoard of mango papaya, some kind of pallid little fruit. He sinks back on the cot, unzips his fly to air out his sweating nuts, and dips into his jacket and pulls out three roaches, and wraps a leaf around them like a cone and lights up. He cuts open a fruit and it bleeds meek white and he puts it aside. A trap for jungle runners. This perfect little snug harbor to suck you in, a hut, a cot, meek, milk, white fruit to eat, a joint of sorts. Oh, to be back in Baskin-Robbins' country just one time, facing endless beige tubs of ice cream, 31 flavor decisions to make, pointed cone or cup style. Paranoia! But this is the real-life jungle, Major. Two-winged flies, dapple-wing anopheles, culex tarsalis, veruga-crazed phlebotomus biting eight-day fever and oriental sores, green-head rabbit fever horseflies, tularemic loa loa, tsetse mites, Mexican fleas, chinches, chiggers, velvet ants, crab lice crawling up from your balls, up your belly, under your arms, right up into your eyelashes for a nice fix of Mexican murine typhus, pus caterpillars, cantharidae beetles, Indian bedbugs, ticks, itch mites, nice for scabies and rickety pox, Pacific Coast female tick hiding in the hairs at the base of the head, sucking in the death bloat with blood, paralysis coming up from the toes. Will it reach the lungs before the big blood sausage mother drops off? a blood bag with tiny feet wriggling like worm hairs. DDT! He gets down and pulls the DDT can out of the jacket and starts dusting all around the ground there around the cot, setting up a mighty defense perimeter against the mites of the jungle. Which is very funny, come to think of it. Down on all fours in deadly battle with the microscopic mites while they close in to slam you away for 5, 8, 20 years. Driven at last out onto the edge of your professed beliefs. You believe that a man should move off his sure center, out onto the outer edges. That the outlaw, even more than the artist, is he who tests the limits of life, and that the movie, by getting totally into now and paying total attention until it all flows together in the sink, and imagining them all into the movie, your will determine the flow and control all jungles, great and small. Next to last joint in all of Mexico. He pulls it out of his pocket and lights up. Maybe I'll knock off the grass for a while. Sure. And then believe all that crap you've been claiming about altering by accepting. Believe it, for you are a goner, and boy, a walking dead man forevermore fading, finally inaudible, like the voices mumbling bitones in the cathedral. And now that I've got your attention... If he sits very still, the rush lowers in his ears. He can concentrate. Pay total attention. An even world, flowing into now. No past terrors. No anticipation of the future horror. Only now, this movie, the vibrating parallel rods. And he can feel them drawn into the flow, his every veruga fly, velvet ant, murine fleas and crabs, every chinch and tick, every lizard, cat, palm, the very power of the most ancient palm held in his will, and he is immune. Chapter 22. Diablo. Mountain Girl stuck it out with Babs, Gretch, Walker, for the sake of the great idea, and she meant it. But anyway she thought it out, it came out Keezy. Mountain Girl was almost 8 months pregnant now. The bus, the movie, was at a total standstill now, sinking into the swamper bogs. One day a package came in by mail from Mexico, a tape from Keezy to Mountain Girl. And there was his voice. She could hardly make out a word he said, the quality of the tape was so bad. All she could make out was he was in the jungle somewhere and paranoid as hell and smoking a lot of grass. Oh dear dead one. Then Babs made the decision to take the bus to Mexico. They were a little paranoid themselves about the heat put on the acid tests. 2 days after the story broke about Keezy being in Puerto Vallarta, the Good Fink California Press ran another big one. Keezy's pals in LSD party in L.A., a barn burner about the Watts test. But mainly they couldn't hack it anymore, not even Babs. Get the goddamn bus moving, that was the main thing. Mountain Girl had one more ordeal to go through. She had to stand trial in San Francisco for possession of marijuana, result of the bust on the rooftop. All the shit in society that the pranksters had liberated themselves from through years of arduous initiation, the shit rolled in lava gulps. She had to sit there, great with child, like a prisoner of war in a bamboo cage, while the straight world put her on prize exhibit and clucked and remonstrated and scolded, and then shook its head and blubbered a little over her. Doped, seduced, and abandoned, the poor miscreant teenager. She got a little prankster mileage out of it even then, although she had to play it fairly straight, just to let them play out their game so she could get on with it. Their fantasy for her was a new dawn for this unfortunate girl, not a beeline for Mexico, but that was their fantasy. Mountain Girl showed up in court on March 20th in a red dress, 4 inches above the knees, and this was long before many dresses were on every eyeball and pregnant as hell. She came to court on the arm of the cavalier Hassler. Hassler was great throughout the whole thing. He was her sanity. Hassler came to court with her, wearing a green velveteen shirt, yellow boucle stretch pants, and red boots, and when the reporters came up slavering for sob stuff, he put them on so righteously it was beautiful. "We must do everything possible," he would say, peering out as sincere as the student council president from under his Prince Valiant locks, "to get Carolyn on her feet and out of this life of crime." Carolyn Adams naturally being the fantasy that the court knew her by. "I'm going to be the strong stabilizing force in her life, vibrating yellow and green. She's had a lot of misjudgment." "My misjudgment may extend to you," said Mountain Girl. Great fun had by all. The sob story angle was the fantasy they all came up with for her in court, her lawyer included. It was like they had all looked at her and thought it over and, this poor misguided runaway girl, 20 years old, lately a teenager, you understand, and more than 7 months in the family way, seduction by the demon Kesey, who left her to take the whole blame for the dope charge, as well as abandoning her with an unborn child. The prosecutor agreed on it, her lawyer agreed on it, the judge agreed on it. So went the justice game. And where was the demon Kesey who left so fast, breathing dope from every nostril? It was as if everybody was going to be nice to her by way of pointing out the lesson of Kesey's evil. Her lawyer, Stephen Dedina, said, "Carolyn is no dope fiend, no dope addict. Her one addiction is a perennial overdose of solicitude for persons who are far away. Were it not for that particular addiction, this defendant would not be standing in this particular place at this particular time." So on March 22nd, Mountain Girl was let off with a fine of $250 for possession of marijuana. Yet if Kesey had left her in a lurch, it was a lurch that they would never understand in a million years. The trip down into Mexico was the bust at its most awful. Mountain Girl, so pregnant, just held on and forced back the bilious as the thing bounced and pitched and rolled through the desert. She felt like a 200-pound egg. But moving again, that was the main thing. Anything was better than what she had been going through. And this was truly something. Every 20 miles it seemed like the bus broke down and Bab sweated over it. All the vibrations outside were bad. Corpses, chiefly. Scrub cactus, brown dung dust and bloated corpses, dogs, coyotes, armadillos, a cow, all gas-bellied and dead, swollen and dead. Babs, Gretch, Faye and the kids, Walker and Mountain Girl. The fantasy this time had been dreamed up by Zonker. Zonker had gotten in touch with them, and Hagen had already driven down in an old car. Now the bus was going to keep a secret rendezvous with them in Mazatlan. Kesey had lit out for Mazatlan after the big scare in Puerto Vallarta. In Puerto Vallarta, Kesey had sure enough had something to worry about after all. Chief Arturo Martinez Garza, of the Mexican Federales, had ordered a search of Puerto Vallarta on February 16th, 2 days after the story broke in the California papers. They had hassled all strange bohemian-looking Americans on the streets and so on. But Kesey had already made a run for it back to Mazatlan. Zonker had arranged the rendezvous for the beach at Mazatlan, such and such a day, such and such an hour. Babs flogged the bus through the corpse horizon day and night, desperate to make it on time, with the bus breaking down over and over again, everybody ill, not just Mountain Girl, but flogging on like it was life or death. And finally, Mazatlan, the sea, the big curve of the Malecón. They made it. This was the flow, and it was a sickening, horrible flow, but they had made it. And they tooled up to the rendezvous point. No Kesey, no Zonker, and no Hagen. It was too much, this particular predictable fuck-up, after all that. It wasn't a cool thing for them to just sit there by the beach in this lurid freak of a bus, such as Mexico had never seen, but this was too much. And they sat there, beat, and let the hours tool by. They were a hell of a hit with the Mexicans, however. They never saw anything like it. Diablo, they kept saying. Women hid their children with their skirts. A whole bunch of locals gathered around the bus and grinned their hideous magenta gums native grins and stared at the crazies. Hee! An old car with no windows in the mother comes by, slowing down. The face at the driver's window with the incredulous look. Hagen. And that old gray head peeking over the window's edge in the back, just peeking over ever so gingerly. Could it possibly be? Hagen stops and gets out. Then the back door opens ever so ginger, and out steps a gray-haired soul with his head cocked to one side, radiating surprise and appall, and not at all happy about the Diablo multitudes. He has on a hinkty, washed-out, faded tourist sports shirt and balloon-seat pants. He walks like a repertory theater shambles. He looks 10 or 15 years older, like an old workadaddy on the 21-day plan to Mexico, aka fugitive. Shit, it's all too freaking absurd, this secret rendezvous. The bus glowing day-glow on the beach at Mazatlan, the Diablo multitudes whooping it up like a cockfight, Mountain Girl beautiful and fulsome with her hair down to her waist and dyed yellow from the last test. They could have sold tickets. You're looking at the new super fugitive, Mountain Girl. Steve Lamb, 45-year-old gray-haired ninny. Certified ID. Zonker's driver's license with the Steve Lambrecht doctored to read Steve Lamb and the birth date altered to make him 45 instead of 25. Mild-mannered Lamb among men, Steve Lamb. 45-year-old reporter, creep and amateur ornithologist, broadcaster for KSRO. Mighty 590 on your dial. Got his tape recorder right here, yes sir, for collecting bird calls. Also, you never know when the spot news will break and the diligent reporter is always ready even on holiday. Old mild-mannered Steve Lamb has learned the secret of invisibility, which is to crawl into the rut, the bottomest, awfulest part of the sunken way society has dug for all those who properly fear her might, oh mighty 590. But hardly seem worth it somehow, with the bus beginning to glow in the Mexican dusk. Fuck it, Diablo, Cosmo, let's bullet through here in the ratlands, glittering prankster glances all around. Paint it big enough and bright enough and they won't even be able to see it. Keezy and Mountain Girl and Babs and Gretch and Faye and the kids standing here in the rat vistas. And along the edge of the circle, a little Mexican-looking girl with long black hair just emerged from the old car. Black Mariah stares out to sea. Chapter 23. The Red Tide. Fucking red tide, man, and everybody in Manzanillo is uptight. Tropic of Cancer, heat 110 degrees, no wind, many mosquitoes, and the red tide killing the fish. Thousands, tens of thousands fucking dead fish floating belly up in the red tide. The stench you would not believe, and there is something in the air spewed up from the ocean that makes your eyes smart. Some people, they feel like they have it in the lungs, like the flu. There is no greater calamity than the red tide, because we live on the fishing here in Manzanillo. Unless it is the American crazies. On top of the red tide, appearing like they rose up out of the red tide itself, we have the American crazies. Fucking plague themselves, riding about in a devilish criminal bus. They ride into the plaza near the great jacaranda tree in a devilish bus covered in crazed fluorescent cholera flowers, gaudier than the red blossoms of Manzanillo's great jacaranda tree. Red tide. And old women and children say Diablo and cross themselves, which the American crazies think is very funny. We do not, however. The biggest of them, with a great mocking grin and American light bulb eyeballs and pants of many colors, comes into our marketplace with a blonde woman whom he calls Gretch, and a trail of blonde children behind him, rolling his grinning head around until he sees that all the world is watching, and then he throws his great arms of an ape up into the air and turns his eyeballs up and shouts, "Eat Alley! Eat Alley! Take me to Eat Alley!" "You mean the market, senor?" Then he grins and stares with an intensity at the poor mestizo, as if he has just uttered the most penetrating remark in the history of all Mexico, and says, "Yeah, yeah, right, right, right." And all the world gives way, wondering, as this strange train goes escombering into the marketplace. There is much talk here about the crazies. Many think that these people are Germans, refugees from a Kabbalah that failed. They mistake their strange talk for German. Some people think that they are American gangsters in hiding. But I think that they came up out of the red tide. Aguaje. In truth. Out in the ocean, where the water was once deepest blue-green, or at worst, yellow-green near the beach, there are now vast streaks of reddish water. As if there were a channel cutting through the ocean itself, stretching for miles, hot and turbid, thick as mucus. The fish die almost at once when they enter it. I have watched a mullet come upon it. She swam from the blue-green water into the red tide, and suddenly she is keeling over as if paralyzed, then struggling to come upright again, then thrashing about crazily as if dizzy, then heading for the surface, where she whirls, flashing in the sunlight, then collapses, keeling over on her side again, paralyzed, then sinks, and then, by and by, without doubt, floats back up, dead. To join the great stinking school of dead fish, dead crabs, dead sea bass, mullets, thread herring, mackerel, shrimp, even barnacles, coquinas, sailfish, marlin, porpoises, turtles, huge gobs of reeking gluey tissue floating in a grisly death school on the red tide. Struck dead. By what? By the plankton. All the world knows that the plankton caused the red tide, as if that could be called a cause. For the plankton are always there, millions of invisible animalculae, thousands to a cupful of seawater. It is they who reflect blue-green and give our ocean its color, although elsewhere they reflect red and make the Red Sea red, without harm to any animal, and the Vermilion Sea vermilion, and the lake of blood arose red milk of sulfur. But here, off the placid bay of Manzanillo in the Pacific Ocean, this little invisible, dinoflagellate, Gymnodinium brevis, just one cell to him and two whips, whipping and darting about, begins to multiply. And suddenly he appears to explode, should one look at him under a microscope, as Charles Darwin once did, and he divides into two dinoflagellates, and they divide into four, and so on, in a progression of utmost rapidity, until there are in truth 10 million of them in a cup of water, and the water turns red from their red pigment, which reflects light, until finally, from the fucking millions of explosions, a poison as powerful as aconitin gives off into the water. But why? Why has it started now, this malignant explosion of the plankton, into one vast immortal group animalcula, 15 miles long and 3 miles wide, immortal in truth? The first little Gymnodinium brevis still lives just as surely as the 128 billionth as the red tide spreads. For they increase simply by cell division. The great marlins die, the porpoises, all the creatures of the sea die, and the fishermen die. But the Gymnodinium is immortal, the instant brother of every Gymnodinium brevis who ever lived. No past, no future, only now, and immortal, the little fuckers. No cause, senor. No starting point in time, just the point at which your game intersected the 256th octillionth Gymnodinium and all his ancestors and successors in old Manzanillo and brought you up tight. We know only that yesterday there were fish, and today the fish are dead, and the poison plankton and the American crazies are alive. And tomorrow we must find out the cause and the cure. Or could it possibly be that yesterday and tomorrow are merely more of now, stretching 15 miles and 3 miles wide, immortal? Then, now, Esau, Judith, Bashemoth, Ruel, suspended in the mucus. What a bummer. Mountain Girl lies on the bed in her room, staring at the ceiling. A piss-poor job of plastering it is, too. And all of them suspended in 110-degree mucus. She, Kesey, Fay, their children, George Walker, the new chick, Black Mariah, have a house by the beach. New. Raw, certified rat construction. Cinder block and plaster. She could scrabble through it with her hands. 50 yards away, across the beach road, the rat shack. This being a Purina chow factory. Yep. Inhabited by Babs, Gretchen Fetchin, and Babs' children. A curious little building empty of Purina chow and glistening with tiles inside. All of them getting stuck and stranded like flies in this 110-degree mucus of Manzanillo with the red tide stinking the place up for good measure. Hagen, with his leg in a cast. Julius Carpin, the hardest head in the West from Berkeley of the prankster outer circle, here with his leg in a cast. They picked out Manzanillo for these very reasons, however. Isolated, few Americans in the summer, off the tourist trail, secure desert island. Stranded in an uptight town, no roads leading north and no roads leading south. 9 or 10 hours of hell by bus to Guadalajara, the only way to get back to the rest of the world. Can't get out in the daytime and do anything because of the heat. Can't get out at night because of the mosquitoes. The jungle beyond the rat shack, filthy with cocoa palms and all sorts of jungle shit. Itching, crawling, alive like a chigger-ridden groin. All manner exotic vermin. Sting-inflamed chigger-blister mosquito heaven, with scorpions for good measure coming up out of the dung dust like lobsters, as the crab-louse is to the crab. Standing dead still in this shit. Just waiting. For what? For bread, mainly. Every day in supplication at the altar of the telegrafo, for money from stateside. Kesey's lawyer's supposed to be hassling up money. And every day some soul like the chick Kesey picked up, Black Mariah, down to the telegrafo using an alias waiting for telegrafo coming from some lawyer in San Francisco. Or from the Mexico City lawyer Kesey's stateside lawyers had gotten hold of to straighten things out with the Mexican police. He was called Estrella. For star lawyer? Who the fuck knows? Here on Devil's Island, us fugitives. No sense of time at all. Unbelievable bad news is all that filters from the U.S. Ron Boise, who had a rheumatic heart, has died of a heart attack at the age of 32. Norman Hartwig in an accident on the drive east with Marge the Barge and Evan Engber. And he is in a hospital in Ann Arbor, almost completely paralyzed. Unbelievable things out of the time-death karma. And here no time, just a dead still now stretching back eternally and forward eternally. So Mountain Girl lies on the bed and stares up through the heat waves rising in the 110-degree mucus of Manzanillo. And she is not high on anything. Maybe slightly out of her head, but not high. No, not even out of her head. But it's like that acid time warp thing. Like they're all thrust back permanently into a primitive time. This is permanent. Kesey can't go back ever. They will slam him away for good. Meaning she can't go back ever, either. How? Back to the bamboo cage to be clucked and lectured and blubbered over until she drowned? None of them can go back. 'Cause there is nothing to go back to. It is all here now. Mexico, even as Kesey foresaw that day in La Honda, and she started learning Spanish. Which none of them really know, however, except Black Mariah. All was in a cocoon shut off from the worthy uptight nativos. Only the pranksters are the primitives, thrown back on their own resources, reliving the primitive life of man with only the dwindling hope of a bountiful miracle from the sacred telegrafo to possibly break the spell of 3,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago, Mountain Girl walks down to the water, the backwater, every day to wash clothes, diapers, and sundry other shit. Every day walking through the heat waves under the salty sun through the scrub grass and dung sand to wash clothes by the waters of the Nile, and the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. It is as if she is walking down to the river and she is watching herself, a maiden, 3,000 years ago, walking down to the river, at the same time, in the Middle East. It is always the Middle East, somehow, out of an old illustrated Bible. 110 degrees, bulrushes, and the eternal laundry bummer. Nothing to read here but the Nova Express by William Burroughs, the Nietzsche and Dostoevsky that Kesey has, and in the Bible. Everybody goes through Nova Express in a couple of hours, but the Bible they can linger over. And gradually, without anybody hardly saying anything about it, without getting high even, they are in another time dimension, biblical tribe, biblical tribe's woman washing in the water, living like the children of Isaac and Rebekah in the first book, even taking biblical identities. They each choose, become a character in the Bible. In truth, it is 3,000 years ago now, stretching back infinitely to the very Genesis, to Esau. Kesey is Esau, the hairy one, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. 13. Did they grow up alike? Describe them. Esau was a skillful hunter, and Jacob a quiet man, fond of home. 14. Which was the firstborn? Esau. 15. Did he value his birthright? The proof? He sold it, when hungry and faint, to Jacob for a dish of potted beans or other food. So thousands, for present pleasure, will risk or lose their souls. 16. To whom did he sell it, and for what? See number 15, 23. Whom did Esau choose as his wives? Judith and Bashemath, Hittites. Genesis 26:34, 24. Did his parents approve his choice? No, they were grieved by it, and Bashemath bare rule 3,000 years ago. For there is no time in this place, only an eternal now stretching on infinitely over the entire world, and all the history thereof. For the world seeketh its own level, which is the sea. And all living creatures of the sea shall die. But the Gymnodinium brevis, which knoweth no time except now, shall live forever. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, the earth is round, but I say unto you. Kesey would lie outside the Casa Grande in a hammock. Black Mariah, in tight black slacks, would keep brooding, staring out to sea with her back to them, which annoyed everyone. They would occasionally snigger slightly, which made her more uptight, of course. Julius and Mike Hagen both had their casts painted most lurid and glorious day-glow in bust designs. Kesey lay in the hammock reading Nietzsche. Who would have thought the old whiskered Valkyrie was such a head into the pudding? And little cycles within cycles. Hagen kept repeating traumatic injuries. In Barcelona, he had a motorcycle accident and kept riding and ended up with a permanently injured shoulder. In Canada, the same thing all over again. And now in Mexico, with his broken leg in a day-glow cast, he felt something grisly under there, and spied a tick, and cut open the cast and found two more and pus oozing under the cast. He closed the whole thing up by wrapping adhesive around the cast. Why'd you put that tape over your pretty cast, Mike? Looking for ticks. A couple of days later, he couldn't even walk as far as the rat shack. nothing to do but deliver himself up to the rat ministry of the Hospital Civil. Give me some speed, Julius, so I can deal with the bastards. Kesey tries to cheer him up by telling him he can film the forthcoming wedding between Mountain Girl and George Walker. Hey, says Hagen, maybe we can get the guy, the Mayor Jefe, to do the ceremony out here. Hagen begins to jackleg around on the cast, snapping his fingers. The dexedrine is beginning to stir and tickle at the boy inside the cast. Fuck that, says Mountain Girl. And a lot of flowers. Fuck that. Mountain Girl looks like a great gorgeous Amazon, and very down in the mouth, with her lurid acid test yellow hair hanging down to her waist, but a little circle of black on top, like a cap where it is coming in natural at the roots. Like Mike, she'll put off the mundane bullshit she loathes just so long as possible. We've known for 3 weeks that she'd love to be legally married, for her child to have legal Mexican rights, and she's known for 9 months when that marriage deadline would have to be met. George, Faye, and Zonk come back from the market with food, George wearing Zonker's blue velour pants, a shirt with broad orange and white vertical stripes by Gretchen Fetchen, and knee-high boots he has painted in diagonal orange and white stripes, and his hair with orange tips from the acid test lurid bleach. All is arranged at City Hall for the marriage, Miss Carolyn Adams and Mr. George Walker, and at the Hospital Civil for the baby. And we'll buy a cot of white. Fuck that. And we'll film it on the beach at sunset with microphones. Babs can run a cable out and a speaker. And music. We can have Gretch on the organ with the wedding march. Fuck that, says Mountain Girl. So Mountain Girl and George were married, quietly, in town. And Mountain Girl had the baby in the Hospital Civil, a healthy blonde girl whom she named Sunshine. At sea level. Kesey in La Casa Grande. There's always a taffy triangle being pulled at the house, what with four private rooms laced with endless variations on the Fay, Me, George, Mountain Girl theme. Mountain Girl is grimming on. Look at this wall. It's awful. No, I'm serious. Look at it. I could scrabble through this wall in 5 minutes. Why don't you go roll us a joint? Can we smoke it in my room so I don't have to keep jumping every time Fay bangs the door? Never mind. That's a tricky question. Besides, it keeps me on my toes in here. Spirits picking up slightly in the red tide torpor. Prankster is beginning to do small prankster things. Hagen, back from the Hospital Civil, hobbling but hassling with the old sweet Vesper boy charm. No stereo rigs, projectors, videotapes to be hassled hereabouts on Devil's Island, but he finds the biggest rig there is and hassles some poor local out of it, a turtle. A huge sea turtle weighs about 50 pounds. Much jubilation over the monster, but nobody knows what to do with it, not even Fay, the pioneer wife and master cook, dietitian, technician, and mechanic. No cauldron they are ever likely to get can deal with it. So they paint a huge skull and crossbones and dayglow on its shell and put it back in the sea, thinking happily of another 200 years of life they have assured it. Nobody in Zacotepetl, Death God Mexico, will seek this one for his stew pot. Babs, after many days of glumming in his Purina Chow redoubt, strolls over, luding out, "Hi, Jed," to Kesey's 3-year-old son. Only Babs in his Beelzebab's best could greet a 3-year-old kid with such lewd, lubricious lunacy. Paige Browning has pulled in, ready to go, enchanted with Huaraches and the rat thing. Huaraches on every foot in Mexico. Zealot himself could not have devised a more devilish troublesome contrivance. They keep 'em strung out on huaraches. You can't run in 'em, you can't walk in 'em, they never fit, they hurt your feet. All you can do is sit tight. That's how they keep this country straight. They keep 'em strung out on this bummer, and so on. Suddenly, Sandy Lehman Haupt turns up, back from way over the edge on a motorcycle. He drove all the way from New York City on this motorcycle, halfway across the USA and all the way through the ratlands to the southwesternmost edge of Mexico. No mean stint even for a Neil Cassidy. Kesey looks at him and can't believe it. He looks stronger, healthier, calmer, more confident than he has ever seen him. It gives him a foreboding that he can't put a name on. Even Bob Stone sails in. Bob Stone from way back from old Perry Lane days. He pulls in a Hertz car. He flew into Mexico City, got a Hertz car. He has an assignment from Esquire to do a story on Kesey in exile. Ah, so the old world still waits. Stone, still hypersensitive, seeing the FBI and Federales behind every cocoa palm, or else scorpions, and in that very moment, however, plunging headfirst, as always, into whatever chaos debacle any prankster cares to dream up, crying, "Listen, this is dangerous," as he swan dives off every handy cliff. hooking down Dexedrine. Stone and Babs go off in Stone's car, high on pills, heading up Tepique in rat country. Come back giggling and carrying on over weird experience with the road animal. They had driven through the dung dust, days without sleep and soaring on decks, scrub country and burrows, and night fell and it got really weird. Stone sees Little Mex bridges and they become Gila monsters, and Babs sees them too. The road becomes the veriest little tightrope between the no-man's land of the monsters, and then all at once the monsters take command of the road. Up ahead, the biggest road monster any man has ever seen, so huge it straddles the road, like a tarantula with legs 10 feet high, on the edges of the road, and its huge filthy body and jaws over the middle waiting for food, and their car is bearing down toward it. Don't dare stop and don't dare go on. No, don't go near it, shouts Stone. No, says Babs, we've got to go through it. Through it? We've got to, says Babs. If we don't, we'll never make any progress. Suddenly it seems the most crucial thing in the history of the world that they make progress. I know, but it's too... Got to go through it, says Babs. They steal for the debacle, Armageddon, the end of all, and sail through it. It's a fucking great road-building machine of some sort, tooling down the highway at Mex Huarache speed, the mestizos up top looking down bewildered at this car that just shot under them at 60 or 70. Stone and Kesey tooling up toward Sonora, nice and high on speed. Stone thinks he's behind tinted glass in a cab, although he is doing the driving. So like a taxi. They pick up a kid, an American, hitchhiking back to California. They can take him as far as Sonora. We're going to California, says Stone, and they gun off.
California?
Says Kesey in the stupidest country way possible. Yeah, says Stone, I'm driving this fella here, Kesey, up to California to see the sun come up. He's never seen the sun come up.
Aw, says Kesey, you're pulling my leg. Ain't no sun come up.
I wouldn't put you on, says Stone. The sun comes up and you're going to see it. Passing strange somehow to be riding in a taxi cab through the Mexican nowhere with Kesey behind a tinted glass.
Aw,
says Kesey. The kid, meanwhile, is deathly quiet. I'm not lying, says Stone. Look up there. There it is, the sun.
God, you was right. There it is, the sun. Why, it fills the sky. It lights up the valley. It shines upon the ocean.
After a few miles, the kid speaks up in a casual way, best he can. Say, fellas, I think I'll get out in Tepique instead of Sonora. I just remembered I gotta see somebody there. So he gets out. Never trust a prankster. And Cassidy. Cassidy barreling onto the rat strand in yet another Cassidy vehicle. Revved up at the eternal Cassidy speed, with the new typical Cassidy Excalibur. He has a 4-pound sledgehammer with the handle wrapped in Dayglow tape, which he throws about from noon to doom like an Indian club, flipping it up in the air and catching it, flipping it up in double spins, triples, quadruples, true spins, eccentric spins, sprocketing his shoulders, his elbows, his knees, his feet about in the jerky beat. The prank and the schism are apparently long forgotten. If there's any soul can break up this fucking red tide and clear the mucus air sailing speedily on all channels, it is Cassidy. So they smoke some grass and climb up on top of La Casa Grande and sit up there while Cassidy circuses and sprockets with his sledgehammer off on his speedy trip just the barest 1/30th second from now at dusk. Cassidy does his wild American sledgehammer ballet by the side of a pool of backwater, and they can see Cassidy's reflection in the pool and their own reflection looking down at Cassidy, but looking up in the pool in perfect asymmetric playback, winking dayglow and dusk, invoking apparitions from the past, a moon door, for the world in the immense act of contemplating itself, Domnu, Sattva and Rajas all at once, funds at Origo, instant movie, now, wet handle Harry. And the Halusian gulp begins to shake its wings again like leather paddle flaps on the Wheel of Fortune carnival game, a rat bird, but it knows the one hole in the sky. Kesey in La Casa Grande with the wind up and the sky cloudy, and the gulp flapping, and the rat plaster paneled with pages from out of Marvel Comics, whole scenes of Doctor Strange, Submariner, The Incredible Hulk, The Fantastic Four, The Human Torch, superheroes in short. All heads believe them to be drawn by meth freaks because of the minute phosphorescent dedication of their hands. Superheroes, Übermenschen. It was passing strange that Nietzsche, that curious little Peter Lorre misanthrope with whiskers and a sour black Tubingen professorial frock coat on, should be into the essence of the thing. And Kesey can hear Bob Stone telling him, Nietzsche is up in heaven now, Ken, saying, I dig what you're doing, but don't read my books. Yet the old Valkyrie was into the thing. The world not a line of cause and effect heading forward forever, but finite and ever repeating, so that all that ever was and ever will be is caught up in now, in endless recurrence, only waiting for the superheroes to resurface, after which a total revaluation. And combining Nietzsche's inspiration with his own of at present best, of man forever watching his own movie and never being able to get to the paradise beyond the screen. As Nietzsche glimmered, life is a circle, and so it is the going, not the getting there, that counts. Live in the moment. Lots of good heads said it. I tried. I devoted much time and much energy to find that those good heads had been tricked. That simple trick of, I was right about living in the moment, but we can never get in the moment. Org! Yet, as pranksters and many close and near believe, he knows he has somehow caught sight of the great flapping beast, and is somewhere beyond this side of the screen and into the true old full bare essence of the thing. He is on to what is popularly thought of as enlightenment, thinking back. Nighttime, and he had gone out to the water, high on grass, and sat down, and the light from the electric signs, Coca-Cola, in the town came across the bay. And every line of light came off straight, the primitive line, Stone Age, the line of grass. Cut to nighttime. Same spot, high on acid, and the lines come off not straight but in perfect half-circles, the acid line, the line of the present, the perfect circle, like the spiders they injected with acid, and they wove perfect little round webs. Cut to nighttime, same spot, high on opium, only time he ever took hard dope, and the lines came off starting into circles, and instead finished with a little hook, like the little hook in the water of a Japanese print, like the little hook even in the lines of that strange comic strip, The Spirit. And this was the line of the future, completing the circle without having to go all the way every time, getting there by knowing the beginning of the trip. Cut to nighttime and an electrical storm in the Mexican heat flashes, high on acid, the lightning breaking out. There, there. And the electricity flows through him and out of him, a second skin, a suit of electricity. And if the time was ever now, it is now, and he hurls his hand toward the sky to make the lightning break out where he points. Now. We've got to close it. The gap between the flash and the eye, and make it the re-entry into now, as superheroes, open, until he falls to the beach and Mountain Girl finds him holding his throat and choking as if he is gagging on sand. Beyond acid. They have made the trip now, closed the circle, all of them, and they either emerge as superheroes, closing the door behind them and soaring through the hole in the sapling sky, or just lollygag in the loop of the lag. Almost clear. Prescavue. Many good heads have seen it. Paul telling the early Christians, hooking down wine for the Holy Spirit. Sooner or later the blood has got to flood into you for good. Zoroaster telling his followers, you can't keep taking Hauma water to see the flames of Bohumano. You've got to become the flames, man. And Doctor Strange and Submariner and the Incredible Hulk and the Fantastic Four and the Human Torch prank about on the rat walls of La Casa Grande like stroboscopic sledgehammer Cassidy's, Fons et Origo. And it is either make this thing permanent inside of you, or forever just climb draggled up into the conning tower every time for one short glimpse of the horizon. Chapter 24. The Mexican Bust. Hagen, meanwhile, was more and more Hagen. The irresistible charmer. And it seemed some beautiful Deb from California had insisted on following him to Mexico. Dear Dad, don't worry about me. I am in Mexico with some beautiful people. Her father sensed beatnik and dope right away, of course, and pulled all manner of strings to find out where she was and get her back. At least the pranksters figured later that was what explained the mysterious debacle that came next on the road to Guadalajara. Hagen, Kesey, and Ramrod were driving up toward Guadalajara in a panel truck one night when they came upon a roadblock manned by Mexican federales. What to do? Turn around? Bust through? Fake it? At the time, everything had been so cool with the local legals, they were feeling strong and confident, and so Kesey decided to stop and just do the old thing of draw them into the movie. God knows the pranksters had coped with many cops before. But, of course, they couldn't speak Mexican, so they couldn't even get the movie going with these federales. The federales grabbed all three of them and searched the truck immediately for grass, which they found, and that wrapped that up. Out in the rain and the dark in the ratlands, The Mexicans don't hassle people over grass as much as the American cops, but they have the same kind of laws, and they are not delighted to have American heads guests of their country, and Kesey was hot, as they say. A certified debacle, in a word. This Route 15 ran along the railroad tracks that come up from the Guatemalan border. Between the road and the tracks were the spiky dark clumps of a lot of high foliage, scrub and shit, thorns, razor leaves. Kesey smiles sadly and goes through a big, well, you got us, fellas, fair and square pantomime. That's the way it goes. The federales take his turista card, which is a fake. Yep, you win, fellas. And say, let me just go over in them bushes a second before you haul us off. Fella has to take a leak.